Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Violent violins and creepy cellos can be as unsettling as slashers, gashers, and great white sharks. Welcome to Soundcheck. I'm Elliot Forrest, sitting in today for John Schaefer. Ahead, the sound of fear. Every summer, Hollywood delivers a new batch of suspense thrillers to get our nerves jangled and pulses racing. In the best cases, music plays a key role in making that happen. Today, we'll look at the music of fear through two classic films celebrating major anniversaries this month. Alfred Hitchcock's 1960 masterpiece Psycho, with its music by Bernard Herrmann, and Steven Spielberg's 1975 blockbuster Jaws, with its rumbling score by John Williams. In a moment, we'll get a view from a psychologist, but joining us first is Jack Sullivan, author of the book Hitchcock's Music. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Glad to be here.
Thanks so much for coming in. Let's start with the basics. This is such an amazing film with such an amazing film score.
Yes,
talking about Psycho. Why is Bernard Herrmann's score so important to the movie?
This is a score that not only greatly enhanced a terrifying movie, it literally saved the movie, because Hitchcock was worried about Psycho. He was convinced it was turning out to be a dud. He originally wanted this movie to be mainly silent as far as music is concerned, going back to his British era when he used silence to terrifying effect with scenes of violence. But something wasn't coming off, something wasn't happening with the film, and he was actually thinking about cutting it up and putting it onto television until Bernard Herrmann talked him into hearing the famous shower cue that he actually composed in secret against Hitchcock's explicit directive. And Herrmann sat him down after the Christmas holiday and said, "Look, Hitch, I want you to at least give this a listen." Hitchcock listened to it and became visibly more animated about the project, which then he continued with to completion, and it became one of the most iconic scary movies of all time, certainly linked with its music as no other movie is.
We're going to delve into the shower scene. We'll hear a little bit more about it. I want to find out some more details about it. But just building tension in general, it starts from the very beginning of the film, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, people talk about the shower cue, and it's certainly that shrieking dissonance is like the cinema's primal scream, but it doesn't come out of nowhere. That main title that you just played, that jolting, haunting highway to nowhere that Janet Leigh finds herself on, that really sets the whole movie up, and the sultry, unfulfilled longing in the hotel scene with Herman's string chords there as well. You know something is going to happen. You know that the music has this great energy, but also it doesn't really go anywhere, so you're unsettled. And so it sets up the context for something bad happening, but not as terrible as what actually does happen.
You actually have Hitchcock's notes in your book, and it indicates, as you say, that he said, you know, music here, no music there. It had worked in the past when Hitchcock had determined that something was not right. Why do you think he didn't automatically go, well, maybe it's because we don't have the music that we were talking about?
Hitchcock was determined to make a movie, as he had done in the old days, with very little music. And, of course, the next movie, The Birds, has no music at all, except for the extraordinary electronic bird special effects, which was an amazing electronic score. But otherwise, all the terror in that music is in silence. And he really thought it would work with this, but when he looked at the rushes, he realized it wasn't working. And you just didn't disobey Alfred Hitchcock's directives, but Herrmann had such a deeply empathetic relationship with Hitch in those days that he just sort of knew how far to push, and he pushed just far enough with this. And Hitchcock admitted he was wrong, and after the film came out, he actually admitted that, I think he had a precise number, something like 33% of the film's terror comes from Bernie's music, something like that he actually admitted.
I'm trying to take myself back. I was only 3 years old in 1960, but how innovative was this music for a film in 1960?
Oh, it was extraordinarily innovative. You had sort of dissonant stinger moments in dark scores, but never a score that from beginning to end is haunting and irresolute, and even something as banal as a car on a highway or a light bulb hanging from a ceiling is just invested with dread. Very gray, dark, uncompromising, dissonant music. Not atonal music, because it does have a sense of a home that you can't quite get to. But and even at the end, that final dense, dark dissonance as the car is being pulled out of the swamp. There's really no closure in this music at all, so it was very innovative. And that Herman used strings alone, which are usually, you know, a marker for schmaltzy romance, was more shocking still to people.
And the critics, was the response good right from the beginning or no?
Not good, not good. The critics, as you probably know, were banned from any pre-screenings, and they were very irritated by that. They had to stand in all those long lines just the rest of us poor schmucks had to, and they were very irritated by that. Some people claim that's why Psycho got panned, but it definitely did get panned. And Hitchcock later on was gloating that the self-same critics who had said it was a blot on his career were now saying it was one of his great masterpieces. But when it first came out, it was a sensation with the public, but certainly not with critics.
You're listening to Soundcheck. I'm Elliot Forrest in for John Schaefer, talking to Dr. Jack Sullivan, author of Hitchcock's Music. He's also director of American Studies and professor of English at Rider University. Let's be clear. Sometimes Herman would take, for example, and I think Jason and the Argonauts, it would all be percussion and brass. In this film, all strings.
Yes. And Joseph Stefano, who was the screenwriter for Psycho, who gave me some wonderful interviews before he passed on in 2006, told me that Herman had conceived of this very early on as a strings-only piece. He called it black-and-white music for a black-and-white film. And it has a kind of austerity and modern bleakness to it that really makes Psycho always a modern film. It doesn't ever seem like one of those old classic movie things. It seems like something that's always jolting and jagging and right now, and I think the music has a lot to do with that.
Let's talk a little bit more about the shower scene. You said that Hitchcock wasn't sure he wanted music throughout, but even in this scene, he didn't think that music was going to be used. And clearly, the music has become iconic. How did this particular cue come about?
Well, it's really kind of a remarkable story because there were rumors that Herman talked Hitchcock into the shower cue right after Christmas, and Hitchcock said, okay, my boy, I was wrong, you were right. But the archives show that Hitchcock, even as late as late January, still had no music in the shower scene. It's right there in black and white. So apparently he had misgivings about it right up till the last minute and then decided to go with it, and of course it was a great decision.
Well, in case anyone has missed it or you've yearned to hear it again, let's take a listen to the music of Bernard Herrmann from the famous shower scene in Psycho. Music from the shower scene from Psycho, music of Bernard Herrmann, who would have been 99 years old today, actually. Do you know anything about the way it was recorded? I know a lot of people had speculated there were bird sound effects, that there was something electronic about it, but it was really just strings, right?
Herrmann was amazed that people thought that because it really is just strings. It's scored so brilliantly that it does suggest those crying birds that you see actually on Norman Bates's bathroom in the motel. There are pictures of birds. There are, of course,
he stuffed them for a living, or he stuffed them, whether he got paid, I don't know.
But so it suggests shriekings of all kinds, including birds, but it really is only for strings. But then, of course, Hitchcock did compose bird sounds electronically and with real birds in his next film.
In your book, you parse the difference between horror and terror. Can you tell me what the difference is?
It's so fascinating. To Edmund Burke, who wrote this great piece called The Sublime way back in the 18th century, that horror is something that's a momentary shock effect, and terror is a much more deep and abiding sense that the world is just an infinitely treacherous place. And something that produces real terror in a work of art, according to Burke, is something that makes you feel like that really no place is safe. And I think that's what Psycho does, that even a safe haven like a shower is no longer safe.
And it was true. People didn't want a shower for some time to come, right?
So they say, especially poor Janet Leigh.
She herself?
She certainly has said that many times. Yeah.
Let's talk about Jaws, if we can. This is, of course, another a classic piece of suspense for the film, maybe the most second recognizable piece of music after Psycho. It's a pretty simple theme, right?
Yes, and it's the tie-in is fascinating because Hitchcock actually hired John Williams, who of course wrote the score for Jaws, right after Hitchcock himself had seen and heard Jaws. And he knew a good thing when he heard it, and he hired Williams, who was his last composer, for Family Plot. And the legacy of Hitchcock Herman really is Spielberg Williams. And it is a very simple idea, just like the idea for the string glissando in Psycho is a very basic idea, or the prelude in Psycho. But there's a lot going on in the score, too, in terms of texture and orchestration. There's a real sense of wonder in the Jaws score, as well as terror. And the interesting thing is that once again, the producers and Spielberg himself worried that Jaws was static, that it wasn't scary enough. And they thought, oh my God, we got a dud on our hands. And then they heard John Williams' score, and they fell out of their chairs just like Hitchcock and his producers did when they heard the score for Psycho. It wasn't as dramatic a situation. It's not that they weren't going to go ahead with Jaws, but they were very worried about it until they heard Williams' music.
And you caught on to the game as a viewer that, if you want to continue the fish analogy through the sharks, that the music wasn't a, if you'll excuse the expression, a red herring. You knew if you heard that theme, that he was really around somewhere.
He's really around somewhere, yes. It's a shark's point of view, and the music establishes that point of view right away.
And the theme itself, a lot of people have speculated what it is, if it's mimicking something like a heartbeat or maybe even creaking boats.
And I'd even thought it sounds a little bit like a scene from Prokofiev's Alexander Nevsky. But when I talked with John Williams about it, he just said it was just something that came to him, and he didn't see it that way. And very often when he performs this score with the New York Philharmonic or the Boston Symphony or any of the other orchestras, he plays other things like the fugue where Richard Dreyfuss finds himself trapped in that cage at the end when the shark's coming after him. There's a lot going on in that score besides that one motif. And I think that Jaws is just a great score all around. And you hear that famous terrifying motif in context, not just by itself. And also it's interesting that John Williams, like Bernard Herrmann, insisted on orchestrating his own scores. He thought it was really bad that so many so-called arrangers composed people's music for them, that the actual sound is important.
Let's take a listen. We'll jump into the ocean. Taking my vacation next week and going to the beach. Once again, I'm not going into the water. It's amazing, and no one must have gotten clean between these two films, between the shower and not going into the ocean. Music by John Williams from Steven Spielberg's Jaws, celebrating an anniversary this year, made in 1975. Spielberg thought it was a joke when he first heard this music?
No, I've never heard that. I think he was very impressed by the music. And listen to what you just played. You have this very jolting famous motif, but also this very mysterious, beautiful string harp music. And I think that for a scary music score to really succeed, it has to do something beyond just being scary. It has to have a larger scope to it to communicate, again, what we call terror, the sense that there's something out there that's mysterious and larger than we are.
Bernard Herrmann often took pride in the fact that he orchestrated his own music. Did Williams do the same?
Yes. He, too, regards a person who doesn't orchestrate his music as someone who has mere talent, but someone who's a real professional, Williams once told me, orchestrates every single note, as Williams does. That little harp glissando you played, all of that is this sense that for both of these composers, form and content are inseparable.
I actually don't like scary movies. I don't go very often between Saw 1, Saw 2, and Saw 3. I saw none of them. But we want to know what movie score gives you goosebumps. Call us now at 212-433-WNYC What movie score really terrifies you? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, or you can leave a comment at wnyc.org/soundcheck. Did Williams learn anything from Bernard Herrmann, do you think, through all of that?
Yes, he did. And I just wanted to comment on something you said briefly, because I don't think the Saw movies are really horror. I think they're really grand guignol, which is a species of sadism and kind of disgusto stuff that's really not the same as what we call terror at all. What he learned from Hitchcock and Herrmann, well, he learned from Herrmann very early on. He actually was so close to Herrmann that he asked Herman's permission on the telephone before he agreed to do the score for Family Plot. And he told me that some of his earliest and most impressionable images were from Hitchcock, Herrmann. And he also learned from Hitchcock how to spot movie music. In other words, where to put in silence, where to bring in music. That otherworldly chorus that you hear in Family Plot was definitely from Hitchcock's direction. And Williams continued to use otherworldly choruses in all sorts of iconic movies, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, AI, lots of others throughout his career.
We're talking to Dr. Jack Sullivan, author of Hitchcock's Music. We're going to continue talking about The Sound of Fear. Up next, we'll ask a scientist what makes scores like Psycho and Jaws so effective at delivering the goosebumps. And later, Sacred Steel star and New Jersey native Robert Randolph joins us with his band to play live in our studio. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm Elliot Forrest, in for John Schaefer. That's the Dies Irae from Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, which is heard over the opening in Stanley Kubrick's 1980 film The Shining. It's another prime example of how filmmakers use music to create tension and fear. We've been talking so far with Jack Sullivan, author of the book Hitchcock's Music. Joining us now is Dr. Megan Curtis, a professor of psychology at SUNY Stony Brook. She's been investigating why certain sounds evoke emotions in listeners. Welcome to Soundcheck, Doctor.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
The piece we just heard has a lot of minor seconds. I know you've done some studies on minor thirds. We'll get to that in a moment. But these minor seconds, similar to Jaws, how important is that? What's the meaning of that?
Well, the minor second is strongly associated with negative valence in music. And although this pitch pattern that Williams chose for this theme is very simple, it's just two alternating pitches, these two pitches they have a very strong emotional association with negativity. These two pitches are a semitone apart. For those of you who are unfamiliar with this term, any two adjacent keys on a piano keyboard are a semitone apart. And in music, this pitch pattern is often referred to as a minor second, and as I said, it's strongly associated with negative emotions. And actually, some of my research addresses this very question. My colleague and I, Jamsha Barucha, have recently discovered that this pitch pattern is also used in speech to communicate negative emotions. So therefore, Williams chose a pitch pattern that is used in multiple domains to signal negativity.
Well, why do you think it is that music or even these intervals in speech makes us tense or fearful or sad? Is it something neurological or emotional? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's something that we're responding to that is perhaps learned. But the minor second, for instance, has a high degree of perceptual dissonance. And the perception of dissonance is something that we have a strong negative reaction to. We're actually born with a preference for consonant sounds, sounds that are relatively harmonious, and a preference for musical consonants over dissonance. It's evident in newborns, so it's unsurprising that we continue to have a strong, effective response to musical dissonance as adults.
I'm not sure that I could actually do it justice. Maybe I should ask you to, but if I were to say, you know, hello, and that would probably be something very positive and a positive interval. But if it's I'm sorry, that it's that kind of interval that you're talking about?
Absolutely, yeah. That was a very negative interval when you said, I'm sorry.
I sensed that it was, but I don't know where that comes from. Do you think it's, I'm still trying to figure out if that's a cultural thing or it's just inherent in the way we are as human beings.
You know, I don't know if it's cultural. I've actually looked at speakers of American English specifically, and I've yet to look across cultures to see if the pitch patterns that people use to express emotions are the same across cultures, or if it perhaps reflects the music of the culture and would vary according to different musical cultures. And it's possible that there's something physiological about how our vocal tract changes when we're in certain emotional states that produces certain intervals in those emotions.
What do you think, Jack? Do you think these great composers that we were talking about have an innate sense about these intervals and incorporate them into their scores?
Well, certainly composers going back hundreds and hundreds of years have identified various intervals with all sorts of negativity and darkness. Just as our guest is saying, the tritone was identified for a very long time as the devil's sound. And various kinds of diminished chords and augmented chords were identified with ghostly and ghastly and dark effects as well. So I think what's happening now is we're beginning to quantify that and study it more precisely. But I think musicians have, you know, been onto that for a very long time.
We've got another clip from Jaws. Let's hear music. This is the section of The Empty Raft, music by John Williams from the movie Jaws. The Empty Raft from Jaws, music of John Williams. We're talking about the sound of fear in movies with Dr. Jack Sullivan and Dr. Megan Curtis. Let's go to the phones. Mark, right here in New York, what scares the pants off you?
The film Halloween.
Why is that?
Because I think the music kicks in right after the first murder at the beginning of the movie, and it courses through the rest of the film, and it makes it even more intense.
What do you remember from the first time you saw it?
Oh, I was a teenager in high school, and we were watching it on Halloween at my friend's house on cable television, uncut, and it just captured my imagination, and it's one of those scary movie soundtracks that I've always listened to, and I've felt it almost every time.
Let me just ask you quickly, Mark, if you do this, if you're at home and you're watching a scary movie, do you just turn the sound down if it gets too intense?
No, you know, I have to admit that I've never kind of put it all together. I'm so caught up in the best scary movies. You know,
okay. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for listening, and thanks for calling in. I know that I just can't take it sometimes, and it's certainly easier to take if that's the case. Let me ask you, Dr. Curtis, do we know if these intervals that seem to have such an impact on us, whether the speech came first or the music came first?
That's a great question, and you know, I don't know if there's any way of really knowing that answer. And there's actually a third possibility, too. Some people postulate that an earlier domain preceded language and music, something that had aspects of both language and music, and may have been something, you know, just that combined melodic phrasing with some sort of referentiality that we see in language, and that language and music actually evolved separately from this earlier predecessor.
You did an entire study on minor thirds. How did you conduct that survey?
Well, I had actresses come into my lab, and I had them record vocalizations, just very simple utterances. They said things like, let's go and come here, in a few different emotional states, communicating anger, happiness, pleasantness, and sadness. And we ran acoustic analyses to identify the pitches of each vocalization, and then we assessed the pattern of pitches within each vocalization according to a musical scale of measurement so that we could compare the pitch patterns that are emotionally meaningful in music to those that were used in speech. And we discovered that certain pitches were used with some degree of consistency to communicate sadness and anger. our most robust finding was the use of the musical minor third to communicate sadness, which is completely consistent of the use of this pitch pattern in music. So the sad vocalizations tended to sound something like let's go or come on, with the two pitches used for each vocalization forming a minor third. Now, we also found that the minor second was sometimes used to communicate sadness, which tended to sound something like this. Okay. Again, this is consistent with the use of this interval in music to communicate negative emotions. And we found that the minor second was also used to communicate anger. So this interval seems to map to negativity in both speech and music. So given these findings, I'd say that John Williams chose pretty well when he chose this pitch pattern to represent the shark in Jaws, since this pitch pattern is associated with negativity in both speech and music.
Some of these minor chords are in the song Greensleeves. Let's listen.
Alas, my love, you do me wrong to cast me off discourteously, and I have loved you so long, rejoicing in your company. Greensleeves was all my joy, greensleeves was my delight, greensleeves was my heart of gold, and who but my lady green.
Ian Bostridge singing the traditional Greensleeves, making us sad because of the intervals that are in there. Let's take another phone call. Anna Rose, she's driving in New York City. What movie really does it to you, Anna Rose?
I definitely think Blair Witch Project soundtrack is extremely frightening, as well as The Shining. And actually, while I was on hold, I thought of the movie Teeth as well. By having music that you wouldn't assume to be scary music.
Right. What do you remember from the Blair Witch Project? What about it was scary for you?
For some reason, like the rattling and the use of non-instruments or use of sounds that weren't on what I thought would be instruments, like forest sounds, and I think there was a rattling of a glass at one point, too, that definitely set up an eerie element to the film.
Very scary. It's on my list of things I'm not going to be seeing as well. Jack, let me ask you, do you think it's harder to scare people these days? Is it more difficult with music and movies? Do you think the game has to constantly be upped somehow?
Well, I think with something like Paranormal, maybe the game is back to where it once was, because that's a movie that doesn't rely on violent, sadistic effects. And it really is a sense of, is there something out there that can get us? And to respond to this wonderful commentary by the phone caller, Hitchcock himself used noise effects to terrifying uses in his British period. And in Rear Window, very cheerful pop music is used as a counterpoint to very scary occurrences, and Hitchcock actually called it counterpoint. So I think that, once again, Hitchcock was a master at all these different kinds of effects, whether they were music that really imitated or was in touch with what was on the screen, like the Psycho score, or something that really gave attention and contradiction to it.
Dr. Curtis, you know, I hear when you said let's go, I certainly heard the tone and voice of my son, who uses it more ironically. I wonder if people can become immune to it, or just use it because they know it's supposed to be sad or funny or fearful.
Well, people actually use this interval in different pitch ranges for different purposes. For instance, if you say that interval in a low tone of voice, it generally means that you're sad. But if it's in a much higher pitch range, people actually use it for taunting. They can use it for sarcasm. The typical nah, that's a minor third. So we tend to use that in a much higher pitch range for taunting behavior.
Dr. Megan Curtis, Assistant Professor of Psychology at SUNY Purchase, and Dr. Jack Sullivan, author of Hitchcock's Music and Director of American Studies and Professor of English at Rider University. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
Music from Jaws by John Williams. This is Soundcheck.